Did you hear what the candidates have been saying? One candidate, and I won't say who just yet, said, if you elect the other guy, we would see our wives and daughters the victims of legal prostitution. Okay. Not to be outdone, the other candidate responded, my opponent would create a nation where murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest will openly be taught and practiced. All right, things were spiraling out of control, and the first candidate said his opponent was a hideous, hermaphroditical character which has neither the force and firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman. Can you guess who these candidates were? Nope, not our Twitter-in-chief. The candidates about whom these attacks were made were John Adams and Thomas Jefferson in 1800. That's right, when it comes to fear-mongering and hermaphrodite attacks, there is nothing new under the sun. Well, we will unpack the history of ugly political insults, contested elections, as well as go over the Veep debate and the Supreme Court this past week, all in this week's Debriefing of the Law. Well, welcome to this week's Debriefing of the Law. I am Joel Oster, your host, and Mackenzie Smith, thank you for joining us today.
I'm here, still standing.
You're still standing. I know it's been a very interesting week for you and for me as well. We got elections, we got the Supreme Court, we got campaigns. And so where do we even dig in? Why don't we dig in with your story that happened to you this very morning? Go ahead and share.
Well, by way of background, as our millions of listeners, I'm sure, already know, I am a Democrat.
That's right.
I am married to a lifelong Republican.
There is hope.
We're kind of like the George and Kellyanne Conway of suburban Philadelphia, except for I'm George in this scenario. So we had a lively debate this year about what to do in terms of putting out lawn signs, political lawn signs. And we...
It's tough in mixed households.
Right, right. We wanted to set a good example for our kids and show them that, you know, everyone can live together and get along and support, right, you know, their candidate and express their views. So we actually, I got my Biden sign and my husband got his Trump sign. And then we had two signs custom made. So we put them out, four signs in a row. So there's Biden, Trump, and then two signs that say, if we can love each other, so can you. And we thought this was
so
a cute,
nice.
Cute little thing to do, a good example to set for our kids. And
great message for the neighborhood.
That's what we thought. And, you know, periodically bikers will go down our street. And so people have been taking pictures of the signs. And my mother-in-law, like, put a picture on Facebook and it apparently got a very good reception.
Okay.
So we woke up this morning and lo and behold, someone stole my Biden sign out of the front lawn, and all the other signs were there. Yeah. It was really
what
sad.
A perfect ending to that story, and trying to, you know, promote harmony and unity, and someone goes and steals your Biden sign. Yeah. Fascinating. So what are you going to do?
Well, luckily I had a spare Biden sign because no self-respecting Biden supporter has only one sign. So I promptly marched down to the end of my driveway and put out my secondary Biden sign. But, you know, being, you know, a hothead like I am, I went back inside and said, I'm filing a police report. This is a federal offense. You can't tamper with election signs, which actually is true. Like, you can't tamper with election signs.
Really?
You shouldn't do that. I'm not sure if it's a federal offense, actually, but I know it's a criminal offense. Like, you really can't do that.
You should put up another sign that says, by the way, I'm a lawyer, and we have a Ring doorbell, so you smile for the camera. We're going to get
you. I'll put you under citizen's arrest, but it does make me sad. I mean, I'm presuming that someone kind of did it as a prank, because no,
right,
you know, intelligent adult really thinks, like, what do they think? I'm going to be like, well, I guess I give up because someone took my sign. Like, that's not going to happen. If anything, it's going to make me double down, but you know, it's a little bit, made me a little bit sad that, like, the point is, you know, we can all get along. It's not, you know, people sometimes act like a Biden sign or a Trump sign is like putting a swastika out on your lawn. Like, it's
right,
not, guys. Like, let's be real here. Like, I hate Donald Trump. I hate him. I think he is totally unfit to lead our country. There is no love lost. But I also respect my fellow Americans enough to respect the fact that they're entitled to political opinions. And unless someone is, like, he's not committing genocide. Like, you know, I have a lot of horrible things to say about him. But, like, you know, there's, it's, we have to also learn how to, like, not just discount the humanity of 40% of America. So let's get a grip.
And that's kind of what we're going to talk about during today's podcast, is that there is this thought that we live in unprecedented times. I mean, the animosity, the infighting, the bitterness. This, our democracy is about to fall off a cliff. These are the end times, right? You hear that, you get that idea. When in reality, that's not exactly true. In fact, we're probably just following a time-honored script that started at the very inception of our country. And by the end of this podcast, we're going to talk about those previous examples of where there has been a lot of fighting, and some of them are quite humorous because what they thought was an insult back in the 1800s, well, it's just comical today. But before we get there, let's talk politics. That's we like to start off with the headlines, what's in the news. And so what did you think of Pence's takedown of Harris during this week's debate? have you recovered yet from that smackdown?
Oh, my gosh, I was crying. No, I mean, look, I actually watched it the morning after because the debates start at 9 p.m. out here on the East Coast, and that's just like...
That is late.
That's too late for me. So I watched it the next day after, you know, I had already like kind of read the headlines, and I agree with the general consensus that this was a much more civilized event than the first presidential debate.
Yes.
I think that, you know, it didn't change my opinion about really anything, or certainly who I'm going to vote for, obviously. But I did think that Pence did a good job of just being a character foil to Trump. Like, if you're a if you're a Republican or a conservative who really doesn't like Donald Trump and doesn't like the things he says and doesn't like his behavior, you were probably comforted, by Pence's demeanor and character at the debate. So I thought he did a good job for, you know, if nothing else, just to provide that kind of steadiness.
So I'm in the Central Time Zone, and let's just say the debate started at 8 o'clock. I'm sure it's a little bit after that, but let's just say it started at 8 o'clock. It was 8:04, and I was already posting on Facebook, turn on your TV sets now. You are witnessing the next president inaugurated in 2024. Pence is just nailing it. I was so excited. It only took me 4 minutes to realize Pence is amazing. And maybe, like you said, it was an after effect of the Trump debate, because I was so, you know, depressed after watching Trump's performance in the first debate, how he was trying to sabotage the entire campaign. And then to watch Pence's professionalism, the presidential nature of what he looked like, it just, I was so, maybe it was just the contrast that had me so happy and giddy with Pence's performance. But hey, I am already campaigning Pence and Nikki Haley in 2024. I don't care which one is on the top of the ticket, which one's on the bottom of the ticket. That's kind of what I'm looking for. Let's just get through the next 4 years as tough as possible. But so obviously we had the Pence-Harris debate. And any thoughts on the Supreme Court? I know they talked a little bit about the Supreme Court during that debate, packing the Supreme Court. Well, what is your take on that issue?
You know, I'm going to be really honest about this. I do not like that Biden and Harris will not answer the question about court packing.
Yes,
I think the American, they will not answer. It's very clear. I think Biden actually said yesterday that he will answer it after the election, and I'm not okay with that.
What?
Yeah.
He said, I will answer it after the election.
Something like, I'm sure I'm misquoting him or paraphrasing, but something to that effect.
That is just wrong.
It is. I think the American people deserve to know what they're voting for in that regard, and, you know, every other regard.
Let me just Let me just put it out there right here. If they pack the court, it will end the independence of the federal judiciary. It won't even be a pretense anymore. It'll just be done. Because once you start and you set the precedent in a certain area, like we're going to pack the court, every future administration will do the exact same thing. It's a done deal. Once you cross that Rubicon, that whatever you want to say, it's over. There will no longer be an independent federal judiciary. Am I overstating it?
No, I mean, I think Kamala Harris made a couple of really good points in that regard. And, you know, she definitely, I would phrase it as we're already on that path. Like the Merrick Garland issue already started us down that path. And, you know, as Kamala Harris pointed out, like Donald Trump has appointed and the Senate has confirmed dozens of members of the federal judiciary that have been rated unqualified, and that's not okay. And I, you know, that's stuff that's already happened, and I agree with her wholeheartedly. That is not okay, and we're already on that path. And I personally blame mostly Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans for being on that path. I really do. I think the facts support that, but
Wait a second. I'll go back further. I blame the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court back in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s was an activist court. They were overturning legislations. They thought, we don't like how fast Congress is moving on certain issues. We'll take the reins. And when they did that, it started this whole idea of, wait a second here, this is now a legislative body that we don't like this. And so I think the Supreme Court carries a lot of the blame.
Yeah, I mean, and I think there's, at least a kernel of truth to that. And the facts are what they are. And we're both going to, phrase them in the way that's most, convenient for our position. But the fact of the matter is we're on the road to a politicized judiciary in the first place. But I do think that packing the court would, if not put us over a precipice, certainly do be very counterproductive to the public's faith in the institution. And I can't imagine how John Roberts would feel about, the court being packed. It's not unconstitutional to do that, but it's, that's not the metric at the end of the day. It's what's good for the country and what's good for, people's faith in the judiciary. And, there are a lot of different factors. I think Congress needs to get off the couch and do its job and legislate so that the courts don't feel compelled to do it for them. Like that would help also.
I don't know that they won't
answer the question.
I don't like that at all. I think, but I think maybe not. I'm always kind of an optimist here. I think what they're doing is just simply playing politics. In other words, they want that to be an issue that people go to vote for. I don't think Biden will actually pack the Supreme Court. I think what you're going to see instead is it be talked about an issue, and Roberts is going to get the message, and you're going to see the most bland, blasé opinions coming from the Supreme Court in recent memory. I just think that's how the court's going to rule. I don't think the court's decisions have been that bad recently. I'm a conservative, and they've definitely not gone our way. And so I don't know what everyone's complaining about, but nonetheless, I think the court's going to be even more mindful as we go through the next several years not to issue any radical opinions, lest they fear that there might be some court packing going on. Well, let's talk about the Supreme Court. They're back in term. Unfortunately, they're still holding sessions via Zoom. There's been no indication there's been a repeat of Fleshgate. Maybe they got the memo on that. I kind of miss those days. We get a little bit of laughter in the courtroom, a little bit of surprise. But there have been a couple interesting cases, and I'm curious if you had any particular ones you followed. But I'm going to talk about a couple. The first one is Oracle v. Google. Did you follow that case?
No, I mean, I have to be honest with you. I mean, there's at least one case that's pending right now that is applicable to my practice. So it's something that I'm following just because it's, something that I'm going to need to know about for pending cases and cases we have coming down the pike. But yes. I can't believe that the Supreme Court is even in term again. I feel like I whiplash. Like when you sent me the outline for this week's podcast, I was like, wait a minute. I can't believe, I feel like the spring term just ended And so much
we're still
happened.
Mowing our lawn.
Yes, exactly. You know, I mean, obviously RBG passed away and that's horrible. And Amy Coney Barrett has been nominated. We're less than a month from a presidential election. Oh, by the way, the president has COVID. Kids are back in school. They're out of school. They're in school. They're out of school. And like, I'm teetering on the ledge of sanity here. So much has happened since July, but I feel like, you know, it's gone by in the blink of an eye. So I haven't been following anything except for politics. And I was kind of refreshed to even sit down and like take a look at SCOTUS blog and see what's going on. It really like
you know what?
Restored my confidence in life.
We're going back to normal, right? This is the Supreme Court is back in session. Football is being played. Yard signs
sort
are
of.
Being stolen. And so, you know, we're back to normal. And again, we're all getting to this concept today of, are these really unprecedented times? Or have we been there before and have done that? You know, I also heard recently, just read this article about how there are apparently a lot of other planets that are more suitable for life than Earth. And the thought is, can we reach those other planets? And so maybe, I don't know, that's just so far-fetched. Well, let's go back to Oracle via Google, a fascinating case the Supreme Court is taking on right now. And let's see if I can unpack the issues here. And the reason why it's difficult is the Supreme Court justices themselves didn't even understand what was at play. And so I talked to my sons. One is 17 years old. The other one is at K-State University. They're all computer geniuses and whizzes. And see if maybe they can shed some light. Here's what this case is about. Can you copyright computer code? You know, coding. It's a fascinating issue. And I don't even know what a code is. Do you have any idea what coding is?
No, but my 10-year-old son apparently does it all the time. I said, what are you doing on the computer? He says, I'm coding. I'm like, all right, well, that sounds like a productive use of time.
Yeah.
Great.
And apparently there's something about the code that Oracle did when it created Java that was so foundational and fundamental to how coding works that everyone uses it now. I mean, it is like standard. It is like the plus sign. It is like letters to the alphabet. It is like the numerals to the numbers to the numerical code or whatever. I mean, the Supreme Court was having a hard time even grasping the concept of how basic this code was. But apparently it's a given. This is such a foundational part of coding that absolutely everyone uses it. If you allowed Oracle to copyright this, it would shut down all of coding everywhere. I mean, apparently that is the message that was sent. And so the issue is, does Oracle have a right to copyright that code and cripple software? It's a fascinating case. Again, I'm not sure I understand it. Apparently, the Supreme Court justices do not understand it as well.
They can barely use a telephone conference, some of them.
I know, exactly.
That doesn't bother my mind. Yeah.
Oh, I can just imagine. I was on a Zoom call just the other day in court, and they were saying, you know, turn your mute off. Your mute is on. Turn your mute off. So you're making all kinds of gestures with your hands trying to communicate, hey, your mute is on. So, yeah, I'm sure the Supreme Court justices have difficulty using the Zoom. And can they really understand coding? That is going to be the issue in that case. And again, this is there's only 8 members on the court. So if this is a close case, what the court will likely do is just set it for another hearing sometime in the future after you get that 9th vote. That's something that the court can do. If it's not going to be a close case, then you don't need to wait for Amy Coney Barrett when she most assuredly will sit on the court come December. All right. Another case that was interesting was Tanzine versus Tanvir. This case dealt with, there's this law out there called RFRA. Have you heard of RFRA?
Yes.
Yeah, it sounds like what your dog communicates. But nonetheless, it's the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. All right. It basically, under RFRA, it says that government cannot pose a substantial burden on your religious beliefs and practices. And it says if that happens, then the courts can provide affordable relief. question is, does that allow people to sue for money damages against state officials? And what happened here was apparently some people from the FBI were trying to get some Muslims to give them some information, be informants. They would not play ball. And so they decided to put them on the no-fly list, which I would think is kind of a scary, the FBI officials had this kind of power. So they filed a lawsuit against these FBI officials saying, you placing us on the no-fly list just out of retribution violates RFRA, and so you should pay us money damages. And so that is going to be the issue in that case. Any thoughts on the Tanzine case?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting case. I think, first of all, it's a good example of how, you know, a statute can be applied to situations that really, you know, weren't even in the contemplation of Congress right. at the time it was enacted. I mean, I think, and I don't know too much about RFRA, but I think it's like from the early 90s, and part of what, you know, kind of the foundation of why this federal statute was enacted was to protect people in situations where, for example, the government was cremating people against someone's religious beliefs or things like that,
right,
where,
right.
you know, they said you should really be able to be protected from government action that really impacts your religious, your ability to
right.
practice your religion and mourn properly and things like that. So obviously it wasn't in the contemplation of Congress that it would be applied to this kind of situation. However, the language of the statute applies, and it doesn't seem like there's really a dispute about that. But I think what happened here factually too is really interesting, because these plaintiffs, first of all, are American citizens and green card holders. So it's not that they're, you know, visitors or
right.
here illegally or anything like that. Like, these are Americans. And the
right.
FBI was basically like, you're going to be informants for us against people we think might be terrorists or something. And they said,
we're not.
We've
all seen TV. That's scary to force someone to be an informant. It's putting
right.
them in a risky position. I've watched enough TV.
Right, exactly. So they said, like, no, we don't want to do that. And then they got put on the no-fly list for, like, years and couldn't fly
yeah.
to visit their family. And, I mean, it really...
That's outrageous.
Yeah, it's outrageous. So they sought injunctive relief first. They went to federal court and said, we want an injunction, and we want you, the court, to direct the FBI to take us off the no-fly list, or at least...
Yeah, so explain for our non...
keeping us.
Explain for our non-lawyer listeners what injunctive relief really means in practical terms.
So injunctive relief is like a court order that tells someone that they can't do something, or in some cases that they have to do something.
Right, so
you're
not asking for
money. Right.
Right, right. All right, good.
So you're getting a court order. So they ask for a court order, and then they schedule the injunction hearing before the federal court. And like a couple days before the hearing, the FBI removes them from the no-fly list and then sends their attorney to the hearing. And the attorney
wow.
says, well, there's no relief now. It's moot. And there's no basis for injunctive relief.
I hate
yes.
that.
I know. It's really egregious. It's really
that
bad.
Has happened to me several times in lawsuits. We'll sue over unconstitutional policy. They'll wait until the eve of trial, and then they say, yeah, you know what? No, we're going to go ahead and change our policy. See you later.
Yeah.
it's a bad move. All right, go on.
So I'm in favor of them being able to get money damages in this circumstance. And I will also say that apparently, even though they're doing telephonic oral arguments, there's still a sketch artist that is doing
okay.
sketches of counsel,
right.
and there's a sketch of counsel for the plaintiffs arguing this case to the Supreme Court, and he's like in a hoodie at his
okay.
desk with like papers everywhere.
Wow.
It's actually pretty cute. It's hilarious. Like, it just embodies the COVID era.
I think I saw that. Yes, it is an interesting sketch. Hey, since you mentioned sketch, have you ever had your sketch done?
So I may
you know
have
what?
When I
Let's
was
do
at the
it.
DA's office, but
Let's do it. You are in Philadelphia. I'm in Kansas City. We need a sketch of us for our marketing purposes. I just hired a marketing person, Brooke Bullen, amazing marketing person, and she is a great artist. I mean, amazing artist. So I asked her the other day, can you do sketches? She goes, oh yeah. So let's see if she can't do a sketch of you and I and somehow put us in the same podcasting setting, so at least that we can have some kind of marketing material for this podcast. All right, well,
perfect.
Now, I think this actually is a very interesting issue, because what also is going on in our country, if you haven't paid attention, is a lot of people are upset with the police. And so the thought there is that these police officers have immunity, and we need to strip them from immunity so they can be sued for damages for bad things that police officers do. Now, as lawyers, I have a problem with stripping police officers with immunity because I know what that really means. That means they're going to be sued all the time because, at least those with money, they will be sued because the damage is not in having to pay the damages, it's in having to defend yourself. And so what happens is all these cases get settled. And so if you strip them of their immunity, all of a sudden they're going to be very hesitant to even do normal things out there in the street to defend the public. So I have a problem with stripping the police officers of their immunity. And is this issue going to be a precursor? If they allow for FBI informants to be subject to personal liability here, is that not a precursor to stripping police officers of immunity down the road? Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think the court did, or at least this was addressed at argument, or maybe in the briefs in this case. I think maybe Justice Alito noted at oral argument that immunity is like a separate analysis. And so even if they find that money damages are available pursuant to the statute, the plaintiffs would still have to go back on remand and litigate and prevail on the immunity issue, which is like a whole separate analysis. So I don't know that that's really even dispositive. And I don't, you know, if that's really the case, then I don't really know what we're arguing about here, but maybe it's
that's the
correct incentives. I don't know.
Well, that actually is a very good distinction. So if the issue here is, yes, there will be money damages available, but the conduct has to be extremely egregious such that the officer violated clearly established law, which is what the qualified immunity is for police officers as well. Did you violate clearly established law, i.e. beating up someone, you know, the whole Rodney King incident, that was a violation of clearly established law, so they would have been liable for money damages in that case. And they say, look, just because we say that there are money damages available doesn't mean these FBI officials will have to pay money damages, though in this case, they probably would, right? I mean, their actions here, at least how you represented them to me, that looks like that's a violation of clearly established law. But then again, who knows what will come out when this case is actually litigated. All right, well, those are some interesting cases before the Supreme Court. Oh, also, the Supreme Court is dealing with a lot of election issues, and I assume we'll see more of those come up. Have you paid attention to the election lawsuits?
Yeah, I know that there's been a couple of stays that have been handed down by the Supreme Court about, you know, changes to election laws, like in anticipation of the upcoming presidential election. And I think the idea is that there's a lot of confusion and scrambling going on due to COVID and the prevalence of or the use of mail-in ballots, and, you know, people are kind of feeling on edge. So I think that the court is trying to be a steady hand, but, you know, you see the way that these things are reported, and it's, you know, the Supreme Court requires witness signatures, and it's like, I mean, the Supreme Court's not requiring that. South Carolina and their overly gerrymandered government is requiring that. And, you know, I don't like it, but I think the Supreme Court, you know, they don't have a lot of credibility when it comes to elections in the past 20 years. So hopefully they will, you know, keep that in mind and try to do the right thing moving forward. But we'll just have to wait and see, I guess.
So here's an interesting thing about those kind of cases. There was a recent decision based in Montana where Montana was going to mail out ballots to basically everyone in that jurisdiction so they can do mail-in voting. And so a lawsuit was filed, I believe, by the Republican Party saying, no, we should stop this. And the courts said, no, you go ahead and allow all that to go forward. And a stay was sought from this U.S. Supreme Court. Now, when you seek a stay from the U.S. Supreme Court, you only get one justice. And usually there is one justice assigned to the various circuits in the United States. And this particular justice Justice was Sonia Sotomayor, who would not really be predisposed to this size argument. If this case were to go to a full court, I would guess it'd be a 5-4 decision, and she would be in the 4 and not the 5. But here's what happens. That one justice decides whether or not to grant your state. If she thinks, or if he thinks, it's going to be a close issue, then that justice can refer it to the entire court to rule on it and comment. She decided, no, this isn't even a close question. I'm not even going to refer it to the other members. McKenzie, do you think that might be ripe for some abuse? Or do you think the Supreme Court justices are so above reproach that they would not abuse that? In other words, could a justice say, I don't want to send this to the other justices because they might rule contrary to how I want to rule in this case? I'm just going to go ahead and call this not a close case and reject it out of hand. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, I don't want to be so naive to say that all 8 justices are above reproach, but I do think...
But we're talking hypothetical justices, not any of the current 8, but I'm just saying after the court gets packed, the additional justices, would they not be beyond reproach?
Well, I don't know. I might be one of them, so I certainly
That's true.
Would do the right thing.
You would.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think certainly there is an opportunity for abuse. Like, obviously, that's, you know, the way it's set up. But I also think I don't know if trust is the right word, but I do have some confidence in the culture that Chief Justice Roberts has created on the current court. And I do think that most individuals who are at that point in their career and have succeeded to that level in their profession have at least some kernel of respect for the Republic and at least the good faith desire, sincere desire to do the right thing. Now, whether that could sometimes be misguided or, you know, obviously that's true. But I do think there's a sincerity and a good faith that pervades at the court.
And I agree with you. And it's also not an issue where the other justices would not be aware of what's going on because everything's public, everything's on the internet. And so if one justice did make a wrong decision, I am sure another justice could squawk publicly and get some attention to that. Well, this all leads us to what I want to talk about today, because people do say that these are unprecedented times. And, you know, I believe President Trump made a comment recently about whether he would accept or allow for a peaceful transfer of power. And he, for some idiotic reason, didn't give the obvious answer. That's a whole nother issue. Let's just derail for 1 minute. If anyone is listening who has ears to President Trump, have him give me a call. I can give him some really good, easy depth prep sessions. No charge. I'll do it pro bono because clearly the people who prep him for some of these things are idiots. But nonetheless, he refused to give the obvious...
Well, that's the difference between me and you. Is like, I don't believe he's like psychologically capable of like absorbing the prep.
Right.
Like, he just can't
hear it.
Here's
the question. McKenzie, here's the question to you. All right, let's assume that you're Trump. All right. And so the question is, let's say you lose the election, and would you accept a peaceful transfer of power? What would your answer be?
Obviously. I mean, I wouldn't be Trump, but...
Right.
You know,
well, even
I mean,
if you weren't...
Even if you only care about yourself,
answer.
Like, you're getting Secret Service protection for the rest of your life. Even if you lose, you get, like, an awesome pension. You get, like, millions of dollars for writing books and giving speeches. Like, you know, you're not a loser here. Even if you lose an election, like, you're doing really well for the rest of your life. So even if you only care about yourself, like, it's not a bad deal either way here.
That is what he could have taken that moment as a moment to really, you know, talk about how great America has been, the greatest country in the history of this world. We've always had peaceful transfers of power. That's what makes us. We are Americans first, parties second. Of course, if there is fraud, if there's things like that, he'll make sure the election is fair because that's what he does as president. But if it's clear at the end of the day that there is a new president, of course he will allow and hope the next president, you know, unites us all, whatever. I mean, it's a very great opportunity to shine, and he stunk it up with his answer. That's why if you heard Pence during the debate, Pence gave an absolute great response. One wonders why Pence and Trump are not talking. That might be why Pence does not have COVID. But nonetheless, that's a whole other issue. I'll say they've not been in the same room together. That's my point there. But nonetheless, that would have been an easy answer. But it does kind of beg this question. Are these unprecedented times? Is the animosity today such that we have never seen this kind of hostility in our political system? Are we on the precipice of our democracy falling? Mackenzie, give me some hope.
I mean, look, I don't think the situation is great right now. I think the fact that someone ripped my Biden lawn sign out of my front lawn
Not the best morning to talk to you.
I don't think the political climate right now is great. I don't think the fact that, you know, we have a president who refuses to answer that question, in the most obvious and easy way is a good sign. I think there is, a possibility, I don't want to say a probability, but there's a strong possibility that this could be a contested election and it could, take some time to determine who the winner is, and it could go to the court.
Is that unprecedented?
Oh, no. Yeah, definitely not unprecedented.
We've had contested, Mackenzie, it's almost like this. We almost have this expectation. If we don't know before we go to bed on the first Tuesday of November who our next president is going to be, our democracy is failing. It's falling down. It's going to be destroyed. We're going to collapse as a society if we don't know by the time we go to bed. That's not what our history suggests is normal, right? In fact, there was one election in 1876 where I believe it was Tilden versus who was the person that Tilden faced? Do you remember?
Was it Rutherford B. Hayes?
That's right. Hayes v. Tilden. In that election, what happened in 1876 is a very close election. Hayes was the Republican candidate. Tilden was a Democratic governor from New York, and they were fighting off. Well, as you had to have a majority of electoral votes. And because there was some maybe voter fraud going on in four different states, three southern states, there was some issue as to who the electors would be, and so no one can get a majority in the Electoral College. And so what happened was in these three, particularly three states, actually there's a fourth one as well, electors from both parties went to D.C. to participate in the Electoral College. So you can just imagine the person taking, checking them off at the door, saying, oh, you're from Florida? We already have someone from Florida. What do we do now? And so that was the issue in 1876. And it went all the way to 2 days before the inauguration of the president when they finally decided who the winner would be. Can you imagine how torn our country would be if we went all the way up to 2 days before the inauguration and you didn't even know who was going to be inaugurated?
Yeah, I mean, and I think that also speaks to the climate of that era. Like in 1876, things weren't great in America. Like it was kind of like a low point in our history. And I think that, not that that's necessarily a direct product of that, but it's a Reconstruction era. Like there's a lot of mistrust and people aren't really hearing each other. They're not respecting each other. They're not understanding that, we all deserve, to live in this country as equal citizens. So I think it kind of indicative that happened during that era. And then we're facing, potentially a similar situation in this era. It's not unprecedented, but it's not a good thing. At the end of the day.
Do you remember 2000, the election of 2000? And so I was actually somewhat involved in the Bush v. Gore, disputes. I remember watching my computer and watching the countdown as they were recounting the votes in Florida. And Bush's lead went from, I don't know, a couple thousand down to 1,000, down to less than 1,000. I remember one time looking at my computer and it was single digit lead for Bush. And I'm thinking, wow, what's going on here? Those were exciting times. My point is, we've been there before. We've done that. Our democracy has survived. We're going to survive Trump v. Biden. But let's go back even further. 1800. Do you remember the election of 1800?
I mean, not personally, but yes.
You weren't there. But surely you've seen Hamilton. I know we've discussed this before, but you've seen Hamilton by now, right?
I have not seen Hamilton.
Oh, my goodness. What's going on?
I've been watching a lot of Netflix. It's not on Netflix.
I tell you what, you got to go ahead. I think it's on the Disney Channel, I think, something like that. At least it was. We bought the Disney Channel just so we could watch Hamilton because I tried to see Hamilton in person, and that ticket was nearing $1,000 per ticket. And so, yeah, watching it online, a much better option for my pocketbook. But nonetheless, 1800, the election was between John Adams, who was the president of the United States at that time, versus Thomas Jefferson. Now, what happened during the 1800 election was for the first time in our history, this is only the fourth election, for the first time in our history, you had tickets that you ran as a ticket. So in other words, on the presidential side, you on the Republican side, you had a Republican candidate for president and a vice president candidate for vice president, same on the Democratic side. Now, before this election, you didn't have that. All you had was, hey, whoever is the top vote getter, that's going to be the president. Whoever comes in second, that's going to be our vice president. By the way, wouldn't that be kind of fun right now if you had that, right? You would have Trump maybe you'd have Biden as president and Trump as a vice president. That would be hilarious if that happened today. But that's how things were. So in 1800, you had tickets for the first time. And here's what happened. Thomas Jefferson ran, and his vice presidential candidate was Aaron Burr. Now, they during the actual Electoral College, I believe they got 73 votes. So Thomas Jefferson got 73 votes. Aaron Burr got 73 votes. And who came in third was John Adams with 69 votes, I believe it was. So the problem is you had a tie. And so Aaron Burr and Thomas Jefferson, Aaron Burr would not step aside. So this then got thrown to the House of Representatives to decide. And the House of Representatives was controlled by the opposite party. So now that would be like right now having Nancy Pelosi decide between Trump and Pence as to who should be the president of the United States. That's what happened. And in that situation, Aaron Burr did not step down. Mackenzie, it took 36 ballots before they finally Thomas Jefferson got enough votes and he became the president, and then Aaron Burr was the vice president. I'm sure that made for some pretty interesting cabinet meetings there when TJ said, "Why couldn't you just step aside? You know, I'm not going to pick you next time. You kind of burned some bridges here. You're not on my good side." But yeah, that's a fascinating story.
But you know what's interesting about it, though, too? What did not play a role is the Supreme Court. So no one's like, yes, oh, quick, we got to get these three people on the court so that they'll vote this way. It was really messy. Apparently, there was a lot of name calling during the campaign. I think, you know, Adams and the Federalists said, like, if you all elect Thomas Jefferson, they'll be looting and rioting and our daughters will be sold into prostitution. And, you know, I mean, as a liberal, I'm reading this going, well, that's what we kind of want. I love rioting. So. But it was ugly both sides. It was a democratic process. Like the democratic branches figured it out, and it took a long time, and it took 36 ballots, and it was weird, and it was messy. But that's what democracy is, in my opinion. It's like I'd rather have that than have unelected justices serving lifetime appointments decide an election, because that way you get something like Bush v. Gore. Like, you know, I think that the election of 1800 was much more quote unquote legitimate than what happened exactly 200 years later. So maybe they got it right, you know?
You know what? Here's my point. Our democracy is durable. It has survived much, much worse. It is going to survive this. We like to keep things nice, tight, and nighty, but that's not always the case. And we are going to survive. There will be a peaceful transfer of power and our democratic principles. I think we are the greatest government in the history of mankind, and it will survive this election. Again, nothing is new under the sun. But since you brought up the topic, let's go there, which is scare tactics. You know what? That is a common staple. Would you not agree during elections for one side to scare people? Say, hey, look, if you vote for the other side, the world will come to an end. Vote for me and I am the savior of all mankind. Is that not the basically the modus operandi of all political campaigns?
It sounds very familiar. Only I can fix this.
And my opponent is the devil incarnate. Look, look, is that Hitler's mustache on him? I think that's Hitler. I think Hitler's come back alive, and that's who I am running against.
That's absolutely right. I mean, if you watch the Republican, the RNC convention this year, I mean, my God, you would think that, you know, Joe Biden is the love child of, like, Che Guevara and AOC, just in a right. Biden skin suit that's going to burn the suburbs like Sherman on his march to the sea. I mean, it's like...
Oh, yeah.
What's actually happening here?
It is comical how people try to scare, how politicians try to scare people into voting for their side. And my point here is nothing is new under the sun. This is a time-honored tradition. You alluded to it. Let's go back and go over some of the great scare tactics in the history of campaigning. Let's start back with that 1800 election. And as you pointed out, let's go over Thomas Jefferson's, his hatchet man during that election was a guy named James Callender. And James, it might be Callender, I don't know. I'm horrible at pronouncing names. But he described Adams as a hideous, hermaphroditical, I can't even say that word, character, which has neither the force and firmness of a man, nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman. For those of you who don't know what that term means, it means you're born with both male and female parts. And so that was the slam in 1800 against John Adams. Have you, have things at least improved since 1800? You've not seen the hermaphroditical attack this year, have you?
No, I mean, you just hear the word orange thrown around a lot. Like, that would be, you know, we're not above attacking people's physical appearance, apparently. But, right. You know, at least we just keep it to bad spray tans at this point.
Right. Well, it's not just on one side. Also on the other side, John Adams had a buddy, Timothy Dwight, who was the president of Yale University. Big John Adams supporter. He warned that if Jefferson were to become president, we would see our wives and daughters the victim of legal prostitution. And then the newspapers picked up on that as well. A Connecticut newspaper warned people that Jefferson would create a nation where murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest will openly be taught and practiced. Yeah, fear-mongering started in the 1800s. Wow. I don't know what to say about that. That's vicious.
Yeah, and it didn't get any better. I mean, I feel like it was like that. It just has continued like that. I mean, I remember my favorite, I wasn't a very good student, unfortunately, of American history in high school. I kind of thought it was boring. And I think I just had a teacher that wasn't very inspiring. But I do remember in the election, I think it was 1840, and it was Martin Van Buren against, who was the opponent? I can't even remember. But apparently Martin Van Buren, I think it was... maybe Benjamin Harrison, and Martin Van Buren was being portrayed by the Harrison campaign as, you know, just an elitist and, you know, a snob, and he didn't have any, he was out of touch with the American people. And so they put out this meme, and it was, you know, it was a sketch. It was a political cartoon at the time, but I think it might've been like the first meme because it was called Martin Van Buren gags on hard cider. Like, he couldn't even drink with the people. He was too uppity for that. And it's hilarious if you look at it, like it's actually really funny. But yeah, it didn't, like, what a drag. Like, they just dragged him. Like, you can't even drink hard cider. Who do you think you are?
We'll put a link to that picture on the show notes for this podcast. Again, yeah, that is the origination of memes right there in 1840. In 1884, there was this hilarious attack. Again, I would be curious to see if you think this one has stood the test of time. But in this particular case, the Democratic candidate Grover Cleveland apparently had an affair and had a child from that affair. And again, allegedly he neglected this child. I don't know. I wasn't there. So I'm going to throw in the word allegedly, though I don't think Grover Cleveland can sue me for this. But nonetheless, the Republicans came up with this chant. And you can just imagine at a Trump rally, them doing a chant similar to this. But this is how the chant at these rallies would go. One side would chant, "Ma, ma, where's my paw?" And then the other side of the audience would respond, "Gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha." So apparently that worked in 1884. And yeah, I have no idea. Maybe we shouldn't be giving people ideas. I don't know what they can come up with today.
But that maybe poor we should child not be... was probably so traumatized.
Yeah. Who's there looking after the child? All right. Well, now I want to get to the culmination, what I consider the most blatant scare tactic I have ever seen. It worked, but it's also now almost quite, I find it hilarious just because it's so over the top. And again, we'll put a link to it on our site. I'll even play it for you here in just a bit. But nonetheless, let me go ahead and actually, we're going to go ahead and play for you right now.
Stakes to make a world in which all of God's children can live or to go into the dark. We must either love each other or we must die.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
All right. Now let's go ahead and this is what you just heard. These are the stakes to make a world in which all of God's children can live or to go into the dark. All right, it was getting pretty bad there. We must either love each other or we must die. Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. Yeah, this commercial, I know you watched it here before we did this podcast, has a nuclear bomb exploding, and so it says, vote for me or you will die. Tell me, at least we've gotten better since the election of 1968.
You know, I don't know that we've gotten better since the election of 1968. I think 2020, well, you know, the past couple of years have been reminiscent of the climate of the late 1960s in a lot of ways. And I do think right. There are a large proportion of Americans who really do feel that this is a matter of life and death for, you know, if not the entire country, for large segments of people within the country. Or, you know, I mean, I understand, like, from my point of view, I feel very strongly about climate change. So if you have a president that's like completely ignoring it and saying it's a hoax and doesn't believe in the science, you know, that is very worrisome.
Right.
You know, but I also feel like we have an obligation to kind of let the emotion not dictate what you not override reason.
Right.
And I think the Johnson ad is like, okay, you're literally just appealing to that part of your reptile brain that like is just right, gonna be in fight or flight mode. And I think that's probably, you know, something that
yes.
political strategists over the centuries have discovered is very, very effective. You just, you know, you are going yeah. to appeal to people's limbic system or whatever it is to kind of get them to be in that fight or flight mode and feel like they have to vote for your candidate or else they're going to die. And that really is, I mean, it sounds hyperbolic, but I think that really is what's going on. It does. And it does work.
It
really does.
there is a segment of our population that totally buys into it. And then they say, let me open up my pocketbook and give you all of my money. And so it does work on so many different levels. I see it time and time again. And the reality is, it's not true. I mean, you're not going to die if you the other side gets elected. That's just not how things work. Even the example you just gave, climate change, let's say Trump does get elected again. You're not going to die from the climate change. Because let's say that even let's say you elected Biden. Biden doesn't control China. Biden doesn't control India. He might do whatever he can to impact U.S. policy. It's not going to, you're not going to die over the next 4 years. Now, again, that's not saying that we shouldn't have better policies. I wonder about hyperbole. But nonetheless, hey, that's not for me to determine today. I just, here's my only point for today. Maybe let's see if you can agree with this. There's been all kinds of scare tactics thrown out there, all kind of smear tactics. People are saying this is the end of society. This is the end of the world as we know it. And I'm just saying, hold on, no. In fact, this is pretty much a standard operandi on how our American democracy works. We have been name-calling. We have been threatening the sky is falling since the beginning of our republic. And so we are going to be just fine on November 5th, or whenever the election is, the next day, we're going to be just fine. Things are going to be okay. We are still the greatest country on the face of the planet. Any thoughts?
I mean, yeah, I definitely think, like, we're going to get through this. We're going to survive this. I think, you know, it might create more work for one side or the other, and people will feel like they are exhausted and still have some right. work to do. And I do think we have a lot of, you know, repair work to do in terms of civic education in this country and just basic baseline respect and acceptance of each other. But I do think we're going to get through this. We still will be here come December, come January. Like, yes. I absolutely have faith in us. In terms of us being the greatest country in the world, like, I don't know, have you ever been to Italy? I mean, maybe when you're just a tourist, but like the food, the geography, the beaches, they've really got it all. And they have free healthcare. Just saying.
You know what? If you had included coffee in there, I might have been on the next plane out. No, I'm a homer. What can I say? So, all right. Well, thank you so much. That is this week's and every week that comes up during this election season. It's going to be fun, fascinating, all kinds of great stories to talk about. So, until next week, have a great week.
You too. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a mess. Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. And Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.